We have to tell her that. That's a signal. And we're going to open with prayer. Bless thy beasts and singing birds, O Lord, and guard with tenderness small things that have no words. When all thy creatures are greeting this morning with songs and shouts of joy, let us not wear dull and sullen faces. And may the words of my lips, the meditation of our hearts, be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. We will hear now from Scripture, first of all, 1 Kings 19, verses 13, 14, and up to Damascus, I think it is. Halfway through that third verse. Somebody got it?
I'll read it.
Very good.
And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thy altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And the Lord said to him, "Go, return to your way to the wilderness of Damascus."
Very good. And the next one is Job 3, 1 through 3. Somebody got that?
After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night which said, a man-child is conceived."
All right. And Psalm 22, 1 and 2.
I have it. My what? God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me, from the words of my groaning? O my God, I cry by day, and thou dost not answer, and by night I find no rest.
All right, now some of you have probably figured out what I'm talking about, and I've entitled it Adversity, a Severe but Vital Taskmaster. And I'll also read from contemporary literature, from the late great anthropologist Lorne Eisley, from Night Country. In this book are these words: "It strikes me now that in few other centuries has the way seemed darker, or the maps we carry in our pocket more contradictory, if not undecipherable." Some time ago I walked through our Washington State University veterinary clinic, and I always like to see posters or cartoons on the walls, and this was a picture of a cool, calm, contented, and collected orangutan, one of the higher apes. And the caption under the picture was, "If you can keep calm in times like these, you just don't know the situation." Now, one doesn't really have to be prophetic to realize that a lot of people, probably everyone at some time or another, are gripped with discouragement that borders on despair. And this affects me very deeply. In my own situation, there seems to be more to learn than I can learn. There is more to be done than I can ever do, even working very long hours. There are more things changing than I can absorb. And too often things seem to be crumbling around me, more things than I can shore up. And there's more holes in the dike than I can plug with my fingers. In my travels across much of the Western world, from Western Australia to Vienna, I sense an atmosphere of uneasiness and apprehension, aroused in part by the storms of violence that are constantly, we're reading in the papers or hearing over the radio or television. we cannot really read a newspaper, turn on television or the radio. We're not confronted by stories of kidnappings, terror bombings, hostage taking, hijackings, and war. There are really very few quiet corners where peace-loving people can live in comfortable ignorance of the horrors that are happening out there. It seems that an increasing number of us who feel too often that life asks of us more than we can give. And I'm one of these that borders many times on despair. And I should point out that when I am involved in any sermons, which I don't give very often, or Bible studies, I address problems that are very great for me and hope that you get something out of it too. The fall of the year is often, in many ways, although a pleasant time, it's also a very sad time for me. As last night, the days, of course, are getting perceptibly shorter. It's getting cold. I put on my long johns this morning. Had I stopped at 25 Mile Creek, which I always used to do in the fall, and watched the fish coming up the creek, they come up to die. And coming up here, I went to Miner's Village, as I always do on my first day here. And the birds that I would see there in the spring and summer are no longer there. I cannot hear their song because they've gone south. And the butter and eggs and a lot of the pretty flowers that are still come up in Miner's Village are dry and dead. So it's a sad time for me. But I'm in good company. And one of my favorites, I resort to at this stage and think about, and I've discussed it here under the subject many years ago, of Elijah's disease. And I have Elijah's disease. Or how are you fixed for broom bushes? Elijah had some fantastic days. And the most fantastic day of his life was probably the most fantastic day in history, because he called for a showdown. And he was a real tiger, if you recall this. Tigers like showdowns. And he felt that the whole problem was Jezebel and these awful prophets of Baal. Now, he had gotten their attention. He got a lot of attention because he shut off the heavens from rain for 3 years. You can get people's attention that way. And then he called for a showdown against the prophets of Baal, and the multitude were gathered. The Baal prophets were first. They were going to call down fire and consume the sacrifice. And to the tauntings of Elijah, they failed. And then he called down fire, but first of all, he really wet it down. It is a soggy mess. Huh? And he called down fire and consumed it. And that wasn't enough. And he polished off an afternoon's work, killed 450 prophets of Baal, which is no small undertaking. And then he went up on the mountain, or on the hill, and he called for rain to come. And then in torrents of rain, he ran ahead of Ahab's chariot into Jezreel. Now, on television, this would have made millions. There's no day like this. And you'd say, now he's got it. Huh? The troubles are over. It's all downhill now. Well, it really wasn't, was it? Jezebel, she wasn't there for the showdown, as far as I know. Now, some of you may see. I'm going by memory here, and that's a hazard at 65. But Jezebel said, if I recall, she said, so may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as one of them by this day tomorrow. In other words, she said to Elijah, by the tomorrow afternoon, you're dead. Well, you'd think after all of this, and Elijah had all kinds of other conquests. I mean, they were fantastic. But he took off on a dead run after all this. And he ran and to Bathsheba and found a broom bush and got under and slept for a while. And everybody needs a broom bush now and then. And then he had some unusual ministry to him. An angel came and brought him food. And in fact, they must have given him some pretty good food because he went for 40 days on it. And even yesterday's meals here wouldn't do that for me. Well, and I often wondered why. Why did this happen to Elijah? And Fritz can explain this from a psychological standpoint. You can ask him about it. But my own view on it is that you never want to make a decision, big decisions, when you're fatigued and overcome. And things can get to you, and you need a rest now and then. And I'll rest tomorrow, Chief. She's always after me to rest more. I call her Chief. That's my wife. And the other thing about it, I made some decisions when I was exhausted, and they were bad decisions. One of them I made, I ended up in 5 miles behind the lines and in prison. And the other thing is, I don't think Elijah understood God's plan. Elijah was he's like a lot of us. He liked showdowns. That's why a lot of people like football games and basketball games and sudden death playoffs. We like a decision. Ties are no good. We want decisions. And that was true for Elijah. He was going to have a decision, and that was going to be it. But it doesn't work that way. Most problems are certainly more complicated than that. And evil is more pervasive. God doesn't organize and keep books that way. God knows how elusive and pervasive that evil is. And there's evil in the good, and there's good in the bad. And we have trouble with that. We like to separate the good guys with the white hats from the bad guys. And we work on a binary system, don't we? Yes or no. And it really doesn't work that way. Because the good guys are not all good, and the bad guys are not all bad. And the same thing goes for the gals. So God's will cannot be equated to fleeting of passions of any person or any age. God's followers must learn to live on a schedule of deferred payments. God's plan doesn't neatly come together as we describe neat. Now, another reason, I think, for Elijah's problems was a serious case of self-pity. And self-pity is one of our most costly luxuries today. And I'm not one who is immune from it. Self-pity is to be avoided, for it retards healing, prolongs grief, and generally blunts our effectiveness. Now, Elijah had a bad case of self-pity. And self-pity is a perennial temptation of the morally superior people. Even St. Paul was not immune from it. And what Elijah was really saying to God, all this I did for you, and what are you doing for me? He was shedding crocodile tears. He didn't need a piece of Kleenex, he needed a whole box. And God found Elijah under a broom bush, and he refreshed him there. But then, as the first reader noted, what did he say to him? Go back through the wilderness to Damascus. We are people under a command. He was under a command, and he reminds us that we better get back to it, to work in his master plan. And we can't stay under the broom bush forever. I was in combat in World War II, and absent without leave was a serious offense, and desertion could mean your life. So it's serious business, very serious business. Now, Elijah had the situation analyzed. An analysis, or fine, they have their place, but you can go to hell doing analysis. For what God required now was action, decision, and discipleship. Now I'll give you a couple more that are examples of people in trouble. And you heard Job, what Job said. In rapid succession, the Chaldeans drove off his camels. The Sabaeans stole his oxen. Lightning killed his sheep. The whirlwind killed his sons. And he contracted a horrible disease. Or you can take God's chosen people who were really taken from through the bite throughout history. They'd lost everything they had when they had been taken from their homeland to Babylonian exile. And they'd been there for a very long time. In fact, some of them knew no other life save exile. Their homes had been destroyed, their temples were demolished, and their priesthood was non-functional. They had suffered great adversity. Many were in deep despair. In fact, matters were so bad, even youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall fall exhausted. And when that happens to the youth, then you know as a nation you're in trouble. Or the most famous of the apostles, man who's had probably more influence on the people, person in the last couple of thousand years, and the other is Paul of Tarsus. And by our standards, life had been dealt him a pretty bad deck, really. In addition to a permanent handicap, he had served many prison sentences, faced death again and again, been beaten by the regulation 39 stripes by the Jews 5 times, been beaten with rods 3 times, stoned once, shipwrecked 3 times on the open sea for 24 hours. And I was washed off a ship and only was out for 45 minutes without an operable life belt. Been in constant danger in rivers and floods from bandits, from his own countrymen, and from pagans. He knew exhaustion, pain, long vigils, hunger and thirst, doing without meals, lack of clothing. He learned that to live was to suffer. And this is a very important subject today. We have to come to realize, and especially the youth, but us too, that life is difficult. Life is to suffer. And these happen to be the first words of a bestseller right now entitled The Road Less Traveled by a fellow named Scott Peck, who's a psychiatrist. He also wrote a book called The People of the Lie. He went on to say that most people do not fully see and understand this truth, that life is difficult. And it takes self-discipline and an understanding of this. And once you realize that life is difficult, then you can go on. You don't go around trying to figure out why life is cruel and miserable on many occasions. And other religions recognize this. The first of the noble truths of Buddha taught that life is suffering. And George Bernard Shaw understood this when he had one of his characters in a play state. Oh, don't talk to me about comfort. Comfort makes winter a torture, spring an illness, summer an obsession, and autumn only a respite. Reminds me of Minnesota. What makes life so difficult is that the problems we face and try to solve involve a painful process. These problems variously frustrate us, they anger us, or cause anguish, anxiety, regret, grief, or even despair. It moves some of us even to contemplate suicide. It moves others to grow stronger, to overcome adversity. And one of these I'd like to tell you about is Jeanette Picard. When I went to in 79 to give the Wesley Spink lectures at the University of Minnesota, the Medical School, Veterinary School, and then at Duluth, we got a little early, we arrived early, and our daughter Becky, who was teaching at Dakota Tech at the time, south of Twin Cities, says, I'd like to go down and hear Jeanette Picard. And I says, I'm all for that, because I knew about Jeanette Picard. She recently died. One of my regrets is she'd invited me to tea and I never was able to take her off. But on that day, she addressed the subject of adversity. At the age of 2, her identical twin was playing with matches and caught herself on fire and burned her to death. And that's a terrible thing. I caught on fire one time, but all I got is a few scars on it. And then she attached more to her next older sister, who was at the age of 5 to 7, she developed peritonitis from a ruptured appendix and died. At the age of 11, Jeanette decided she wanted to be a priest in the Episcopal Church. At 21 years of age, she qualified for seminary. But of course, she couldn't make it. She wasn't admitted for one principal reason. She was the wrong sex. So she went to the University of Chicago, where she met a fellow named Jean Picard, who was also an identical twin. They married and had some children, and he was offered a position in the university in his native Switzerland. It didn't work out well, so it was more adversity, but he received a position at MIT. He wasn't there very long, and he was attracted to business because business was doing so well about in 1928. Some of you don't remember that, but they were a golden era. And he wasn't there long before the 29 crash came, and he was out of a job and had their children. Well, Jean Picard's brother, with whom he worked and developed the bathyscope for investigations undersea. His brother was called by the government, wondering if he's interested in exploring the stratosphere. And he's busy, why don't you call my brother Jean? So they hired him and of course Jeanette came with him. And they set a lot of records in space and stratospheric investigations. Exploration. In her 70s, she finally got into seminary and was ordained, I think, as the first woman in the Episcopal Church at the age of 79. And her story on adversity made a lot of sense. Well, I've reviewed my own case. And I sometimes identify with Job, but when I read it, then mine don't look so big. But in the last number of years, I have been often on the point of despair. The ultimate tragedy is something that Fritz and I will discuss on Thursday night. But the race that you want to win as a parent is the race to the grave. We lost that one 2 years ago by a former staff member here, our daughter Karen, after 2 years in Cameroon, just before she was to come home. we got the call that nobody wants to receive. Your daughter died. A year before that, a girl who I guess I was the closest thing to a father to her was a Chicano. She came into my class at the University of California, overweight, poorly dressed, stuttered. I wondered what she was doing there. She's one of 10 children from a literate mother. She didn't know her father. But I came to know her as a person, and a remarkable person she was. We employed her and helped her with a master's and helped her get into medical school. And she finished medical school, the first one in her family to obtain a professional degree. And the year before Karen died, she was the same age as Karen. She died with intestinal carcinoma at the age of 33. Eight weeks ago, last Wednesday, a fellow that was like a brother to me and the vice president of the Delta Society, which I'm president, and he was one of the pioneers in the whole movement of using animals to help people as a psychiatrist and as a member of the faculty of our regional program, veterinary medicine, and also the medical school in Portland. One of his patients came in and blew out his brains. Left five children, the youngest of which is two. A few years ago, my wife, I came home. She could no longer hear me. I didn't realize, although I'd worked with hearing handicapped, how difficult a hearing handicap can be. We'll talk about that tonight. She's had cancer and several operations and many other problems. But you know, there is hope in all of this, but it's also instructive. Although I'd worked with hearing handicapped, now I'm really more qualified to deal with that and to help other people to how to handle handicaps, especially hearing handicaps. I would not be involved in Amnesty International to helping prisoners of conscience if I myself had not been a prisoner. I would probably not be so involved in Bread for the World if I hadn't learned what hunger really is. I mean real hunger, where that's all you think about is trying to get food. I wouldn't be as effective, I don't think, in grief counseling had not I not been that route, have walked through that valley. To lose somebody before the shadows of their life touch noon. When you lose not only a lot of the past, but a lot of the future. And in several areas, because we have experienced this, we can help. And if we are not here to help other people and their animals, there is no just and sufficient reason to be here. Now I will admit that in my own situation, I do live in a sense of imminent disaster and catastrophe. I always worry when any member of the family is due to arrive home. I'm uneasy until they arrive. I don't like the telephone to ring, especially late at night and early in the morning. I've become very aware of the uncertainties of life. And I have to admit that in many occasions I move to ask God, why don't you listen to me? Why do you permit these terrible things to happen? I call God and there seems to be no answer. Nobody picks up the phone. I don't even get an intercept or a busy signal. On many occasions I've been moved with the psalmist to say, O God, why hast thou forsaken me? And then I realized that someone else under very special circumstances, in fact, under the very worst of circumstances, from a cross, had said the same thing. So that's why I can stand or sit before you today and justify adversity and give you words of hope and strength. And I recall what Job said. And the chosen people, and the Apostle Paul, hear their response to some of the terrible suffering. What about Job? The Lord gave, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. 2 years ago, that came pretty hard. It still comes hard. Though he slay me, I will trust him. For I know that my Redeemer lives and at last will stand upon the earth. In Babylon, where Isaiah was ministering to the Israelites in exile, he not only recognized their terrible conditions and the great despair when he said, even youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall fall exhausted, but he also said, they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up like on wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. And Paul had a lot to say. In chains, facing the king who had the power of life and death over him, said, I wish to God that not only you, but all those who are listening to me today may become what I am, apart from these chains. And nearing the end of his most difficult life, he wrote to the Corinthians, seeing then that we have been entrusted with this commission, which we owe entirely to God's mercy, we never lose heart. We never lose heart. It would be a very great thing to never lose heart, but we so often do when we are overwhelmed by the shadows of adversity, the shadows of great sorrow, the shadow of death, and the shadow of nameless shame. How one reacts to adversity is really the true test of us. Will it send us to the depths of despair, or will it lift us to new heights of effective service? And I am here to remind you that history confirms that people are most dynamic and creative when struggling against great odds, which characterized the Apostle Paul. To say we never lose heart is quite a statement. A fellow named Dr. Campbell reminds us that Paul found his assignment under very strange circumstances on the Damascus Road. God met Paul with a vision of Christ who suffered the worst of anyone in history, and turned Paul directly around to another ministry, reminding Paul that the whole business was no longer in Paul's hands, but in God's hands. God was now calling the shots. And Paul never would be the same again, and he would never be safe from all manner of hazards again. He went through terrible ordeals, but he had a new place in the world, and now he knew who he really was. The center of life was moved from himself to God, and he encountered him in Christ. He was a new man who would never lose heart again, and that's why he could write confidently to his Christian friends in Corinth. Seeing then that we have been entrusted with this commission, we never lose heart. Now, the remarkable and wonderful thing about all of this is this experience of Paul, of Job, and really of Elijah, when he heard the still small voice. It's also possible for the likes of you and me. We too have been entrusted with an assignment, a task, a mission, a ministry. God has commissioned each one of us for a particular task, for particular tasks in this world. We are to do what one of the things that my wife has on her refrigerator door. We're to bloom where we're planted. And it might be in a bunch of Canadian thistles. That's, I'm sure, where she thinks she is sometimes. Answering this assignment with God's help, we'll never lose heart. Hard pressed on every side, we are never hemmed in, bewildered. We are never at our wit's end. Hunted, we are never abandoned to our fate. Struck down, we are not left to die, for we have a life insurance that we will live forever. You and I are not called to easier tasks, but to greater causes. We are called not to peace, but to battle. We are directed not to some snug harbor, but to some storm-tossed sea. And with God's help, we'll not lose heart, as we recall Paul's words to the Romans in 8:18. Somebody read that, please.
Which is one of my favorite chapters. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us.
Yeah, and that's one you never forget. And then the words of Timothy, I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. If you keep the faith, we will never lose heart. And that's my word for you today. Now it's your turn to tell about your adversity. That is, if you had something. Yes.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with what you said. I was surprised when I heard you said you were a prisoner. Well, I was a prisoner of the Japanese for 3 years.
That's even worse.
9 months. But that gave me strength. I'm today because of it. Yeah. And I do feel like standing.
Well said.
those who would like to hear, I do have a tape in my library from last year.
You did a tape here?
Yes, it was on when we started the Pastor Wick and Susan Kyle, wasn't it?
Do you remember the title of that?
Death and the Dying. My tape was Baton Death March.
Okay.
Because I survived it.
One of the few. I always carry something with me. I got this card one day, and it said, "A friend is one who comes in when the whole world goes out." It's a picture of a cat. I might have a slide of that. I opened it up, and it's a letter from someone I never met. Her name is Hope, and I have her permission to read this. She was also a prisoner of the Japanese. She was in Berhala, which is one of the worst of the war. And when she was 19 years old and lived in Borneo, she was taken prisoner. My mother, when she first saw me, I was released. She fell to the ground in a dead faint. My dad, a devout Christian, cursed heaven and hell. I know I looked terrible. The last time they had seen me before the war, I was a beautiful 19-year-old girl. When I came home after the war, I only weighed 70 pounds. My tongue had been cut. I could not form words plainly. My elbow was crooked from a bad break. My jaw had been broken, and many of my teeth were gone. My eyes were filmed over from so many years of malnutrition. Two of my toes were missing, and many of my feet bones were crushed. I could barely walk. I suffered from malaria, scurvy, beriberi, shigella, dysentery, and impetigo to the 9th degree. But as terrible as I looked, my emotional state was worse. And I feel more critical. I'm sure you recognize that in your associates. And then she went on to say that they didn't really recognize it, but she didn't talk about all the blood and brutality and the beastliness of the place she had just left. My ultimate reaction to all of this was to withdraw myself and not allow myself to trust or love or be loved in return. I was full of fear and hate, but I had a loving, compassionate family, and with their help I crept back into civility and stability. It took 12 years to come back. You really don't fully come back. And I'm sure you suffer the same as I. You have replays, and sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night screaming. I was fortunate some of the people from there could not make the journey back. 9 years ago, my mother and father died, and within 5 weeks of each other. I don't have the words to express to you how this affected me. I didn't even cry or mourn or grieve. I went into the deepest depression one can imagine. It was POW camp all over again. I mean, those were my feelings. This time I was living in Chico, California. I was a student at the university there. And she told how a cat came into her life. And she suddenly got diverted by this, because she was going to kill herself. And so she ran in the house and got this cat something. She said, in fact, she named this cat Lala. She says, "He's beside me now as I write this letter to you. I named him Lala, which was the name the nuns gave me during the war in camp. It's a Malay word meaning precious or beautiful. It gives me great joy and saved my life. When I was in Australia just 2 years ago, I got an emergency letter from her. The cat had died, and she was going to kill herself. Well, fortunate that she had some other cats, and she decided that they'd be in bad shape if she killed herself, so they sort of saved her, and she was agnostic. But now she is Christian. In spite of having all this trouble, having lost her job and her money, and had cancer. And but she's still buoyant. If I brought her in here today, she's in Southern California. I mean, you wouldn't believe this. Huh? She's upbeat and knows where she's going now. So we can make it, no matter how tough it gets.
How do our struggles compare to animals?
Well, we're going to get into this. I'll discuss this on Thursday night. That's one of my big concerns, of course. We do not have real reverence for life. In our generation, our human life has become, the cost in human life has been greater than any other generation. Life is a recyclable item, both people and animals. We got to start taking killing seriously. We've got to have a reverence for life, which is a course I started teaching about 5 years ago because of this, of the genocide and zoocide. And we think of the Holocaust. What we have to recognize are the Holocausts. There were many, as bad as the Holocaust of the Jews was, when I saw some of these victims. And I can see them now. It is one person. I mean, it was the Walking Dead, and it haunts me. But there were even more others killed than the Jews. The Gypsies were essentially wiped out. A lot of the Poles, a lot of Christians, the Armenians, more recently the Afghanistans, the Cambodians. And then Paul Bowe will tell you about the Indians. My wife couldn't finish reading the book Wounded Knee. We gotta take killing seriously. And we're not. We bring all this suffering on to so many animals and people. So we gotta have a turnaround on this. And that's what I'm up to. I know you are too. But I'll get in more. I'll discuss grief in animals. And or what looks like grief. And some people, I can give you examples. The loss of their animal was worse than the loss of one of their family. And their suffering is more. Now, I can't explain that. But it's true. In fact, one of the girls I'm helping through veterinary school right now, a terrible history. Doesn't know her father. Left at age of 3. Never married again. And she nursed her from the age of 10 to 12 when she died from diabetes. And then made her own way. Never went to high school. She took a correspondence because she had to cook for her 3 older brothers and her stepbrothers and her father. And they never helped her either. But when her dog died at 9, the grief was greater than when her mother died. But it's the age, and also she was prepared for it.
A dear friend of mine who died of cancer said something about 15 years ago that I would never forget. And she said she believed that the Lord brought adversity and suffering on those who could best come through it and be a living witness to others.
Yeah. I have trouble with them. It was God's will that this happens, you know, but he permits it, perhaps, or in our freedom. There's a good book on this by Weatherby, I have discussed this here. In fact, last year, if you're interested in this subject, but that raises, I mean, we will not be taken beyond our capacity. Well, temptation, but we, two wonderful people, Elmer Witt and Gertrude Lundholm, and I did a thing here on I think probably grief is the price of loving or something. We did one because Elmer Witt had recently lost his wife. Gertrude had lost her husband, and we'd lost her daughter. And it was a very difficult session, but I think helpful to some people, and some of you may find help in this. And I discuss, I think, of the so-called God's will, and quote from him. I think I did anyway. Although I don't remember what happened 5 minutes ago. No, you're discussing agent quality. I don't know if you've had this problem, but we got to end on a lighter note too. I run down. I often go down the basement to get something. By the time I get down the basement, I've forgotten. Well, I don't feel like, you know, coming right back up because my wife will know that I've forgotten. Fortunately, we have a bathroom down the basement. Go in there. And my trip isn't in vain. You had a point.
When the concentration camps came up, then I thought that you might lead into the insights that Erich Fromm got in the concentration camps, but the thing that enabled these people to survive. I was hoping you'd touch on that.
Go ahead.
You're much better equipped to do that than I am. My understanding of it is that he found, as a psychiatrist, watching the people in the concentration camps, who survived and who did not, he found that survivors were those who had a purpose for living, particularly a purpose outside themselves. Is that not?
That's right.
Would that be a good description of it?
Well, school is out then.
and